Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has been unbelievably important in several capacities to, well, the conduct of, and, well, even more importantly perhaps now, the understanding of the nature of that war for the free world is our guest this first segment, and we're going to see if we can importune him to stay with us for a second. He is Admiral James Ace Lyons, the former Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. He served in uniform for some 36 years, rising through the ranks from able-bodied seaman to four-star Navy Admiral, including a stint at the U.S. Naval Academy and service in the highest ranks of the United States military. Admiral Lyons, it is always a delight to have you with us, especially the day after an extraordinarily important hearing, the threat posed to us today and that is coming by Communist China. The House Intelligence Committee has begun what I am told will be a series of hearings looking into different aspects of this problem, focusing in the first one conducted yesterday on the military threat that is developing. I know you have studied these matters closely, though, like me, you did not have a chance to take aboard what went down in the hearing. But I'd want to just walk through with you some of the things that you believe that we need to be paying attention to about the emerging capacity of China to dominate the world's oceans and otherwise project power at our considerable expense. It's so good to have you back, sir. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio once again.
Nice to be back with you, Frank, and your listeners.
So one of the witnesses was a Navy captain by the name of James Fennell, who was the intelligence duty officer in your old area of operation, SINCPAC fleet, I think they, the Pacific Command. This very distinguished former naval officer has issued something like a 64-page written statement to the committee, Admiral, laying out in extraordinary detail the various ways in which the Chinese buildup is now threatening to be able decisively to defeat our forces, conventionally at least, in the Pacific. Does that track with your reading of the situation at the moment?
Well, they certainly have. What they have done, Frank, is nothing short of remarkable, of taking basically a coastal navy and making it into a worldwide threat. And they've done this over a period of 20-some-odd years of double-digit defense spending with a determined objective to first not only exercise total control over the first island chain, which includes Taiwan and actually most of the Philippines, and with their ultimate objective to actually control out to Guam. Their objective is to drive us out of the Western Pacific.
Yeah, I think the thrust of the testimony suggests it may be out of Asia altogether, and increasingly to be able, Admiral, to control not only the strategic waterways of the Pacific, but others as well. You have mentioned, of course, the improved capacity of their fleets. There are also seemingly plans to make it a very much larger fleet than ours, so that there would be not only the lack of a serious qualitative edge, partly because of their theft of our technology, but also a serious disadvantage for our naval forces relative to theirs in terms of sheer numbers. Having served out in that neck of the woods and understanding the vastness of the waters there and the challenge for the United States especially of projecting power ourselves at such remove from our country, how would those two factors combine, particularly if these Chinese trends continue?
Well, we have to actually recognize and counter what the Chinese have done. And for example, you know, they have built four artificial islands. I call these stationary carriers. And on three of those islands, they have built 10,000-foot runways. And even though Xi Jinping made a statement at the White House in 2015 that he would not arm those islands, that's exactly what they've done. They've armed them not only with aircraft, air defense missiles, and surface-to-surface missiles. In effect, they are stationary carriers. But on the other hand, since they're stationary, they are also vulnerable. And we have to capitalize on that vulnerability. You know, this is not the first time that we've been challenged to stay out of a key strategic area of the world. And make no mistake, the South China Sea is a key strategic area. Over $5 trillion worth of commerce flow through that area on an annual basis. And we face the same thing with the Soviet Union in the Norwegian Sea. Nobody thought we could operate above the GI-UK gap. And I see today we've reestablished the Second Fleet, which I had command of, and the NATO Striking Fleet. And the conventional wisdom then, we couldn't operate north of the GI-UK cap. I threw all that out. I showed how we could operate above the Arctic Circle, drive the Soviets back into their homeland. And that's essentially what we have to do with the Chinese. We cannot concede a fundamental concept of freedom of the sea, open freely to all international commerce. And that goes, we have to recognize the Chinese Belt and Road concept of building naval facilities. That's what they are, naval facilities, these port developments that they're making throughout the world. First one went into Djibouti in East Africa, a key strategic location for all the traffic flowing through the Red Sea to the Suez Canal. The second one now is being built in Pakistan and Guadalajara, which actually is another key strategic position for the introduction of all the oil coming out of the Persian Gulf.
This is deeply troubling, needless to say, Admiral, if you take a sort of geostrategic perspective well beyond the Pacific area of operation itself. And when we come back, if I may ask you to stay with us for another segment, Admiral, I want to talk about what we better be doing about this in terms of our own fleet and more broadly, our national security capabilities. That and much more with the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee, Admiral James Ace Lyons, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Admiral James Ace Lyons, the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee, a distinguished naval officer, one of the, well, as far as I'm concerned, heroes of the Cold War, and man who is contributing mightily to our current understanding of the challenges we face through such outlets as the Washington Times, the Canadian Free Press, and elsewhere. Admiral Lyons, one of the things that Captain Fennell has suggested in his testimony yesterday, and we'll be talking more about this shortly with Bill Gertz, who I believe was covering the hearing, is that he thinks that there's a decade of concern looming here when, starting probably about 2020, China has the capacity – to attack Taiwan and perhaps to use military force decisively against Japan and maybe U.S. forces in the Pacific, that by 2030 at the outside, that capacity will be in place. And it leads us to a point in 2049, I believe it is, when on the 100th anniversary of China's establishment of the so-called People's Republic, would mark the moment that the Chinese, according to their long-range plans, are the world's dominant power. This all begs the question, sir, what must the United States do in this period to try to reshape those Chinese calculations and defend our vital interests?
Well, as I've written about this before, Frank, I think it's time for us to consider a NATO-like alliance for the Western Pacific. And I think this the time has come for us to seriously consider this, and we can start the planning and formulation using our facilities that exist on Guam as the central point to start this. And there are certain things we need to do for Taiwan to help them build up the defensive capability. There's no question. Today, China has sufficient lift that could bring two divisions, at least, in an invasion force in Taiwan. Taiwan has 155 millimeter artillery pieces, which we could provide guided projectiles for. This would decimate any Chinese invasion fleet attempting such an operation against Taiwan. We also should be providing Taiwan with our most fifth generation F-35 fighters. And we should also be providing Taiwan help in their indigenous submarine construction program to make them as effective as possible. We need to organize specific exercises, including amphibious exercises, to demonstrate the capability that we are not going to be pushed out of the Western Pacific. This is the same thing as we did in the Norwegian Sea and the North Atlantic and above the Arctic Circle against the Soviet Union. And they were a much more dominant force at that point than the Chinese are today.
Yeah. Admiral, let me ask you about one other piece of this. We tend to think about, and I think much of the testimony yesterday focused on sort of the terrestrial aspects of this rising challenge from China. There is another dimension, though, as you're very well aware, and that is space. And the Chinese seem to be making a concerted effort to be able not only to operate in that critically important domain that's been called the high frontier in the past, but to control it. How important is it, as you see it, sir, to our ability to project power, protect our interests, Taiwan and Westpac and more, to be able to neutralize that kind of threat from China in space?
It has to be at the top of our list, Frank. Everything we do is dependent on our ability to continue to use space. Certainly, it has to be part of our first line of defense. And we must be able to protect our satellite systems. And certainly, we need to have a capability that would destroy any of the Chinese satellites that would be used to operate against us. And this is something that we have looked up many years ago, and it needs to be seriously reconsidered today. We need that capability in space, not only from the standpoint of affecting the Chinese satellites, but also in our anti-ballistic missile world.
Yeah, the space-based missile defense is something we have been talking about for a long time. We've had Ambassador Hank Cooper on the show frequently to discuss how we could have had it long before now and certainly need it to deal with, among other things, the North Korean threat, but also, I would argue, that of China and Russia as well. Speaking of North Korea, Admiral, let me ask you about what is afoot at the moment. The North Koreans have agreed in principle to a summit meeting with President Trump, as you know, in June 12th in Singapore. And yet there seems to be now some backing and filling, some criticism of Ambassador Bolton, our national security advisor, of the exercises that have been going on in the South Korean U.S. Alliance. Admiral, let me just ask you, first of all, what you expect to happen in all of this, and if you would, to talk specifically about whether China is involved now in trying to ensure that nothing comes of these talks in the interest of, again, promoting its regional hegemony, if not larger agenda.
Well, as I've written in a recent op-ed, Frank, make no mistake, while Kim Jong-un will be at the table, make no mistake, we are negotiating with China. Let's face it, the nuclear threat from North Korea wouldn't be there if it were not for China and also helped by Russia. While Kim Jong-un will be sitting at the table, make no mistake, we are actually negotiating with China. There would be no nuclear threat out of North Korea if it were not for China. Everything that North Korea does, in my view, is done at the behest to further Chinese goals and ambitions. So in that sense, certainly the Chinese, while there is some optimism that there will be a peace treaty between North and South Korea, I am sure that while not demanding it, I'm sure at the end of that is the removal of our forces from South Korea as the price for such an agreement. That has been a long-term Chinese objective. And I don't see any change in that venue. Mm.
And this would, of course, create a very difficult negotiating posture for President Trump, would it not? This is calculated to undermine the kind of leverage that he would otherwise bring to the North Koreans to demand only the most complete of denuclearizing of that regime and the inspections and so on that would be required to ensure that it actually happens. So again, this sounds as though it's a Chinese play to promote their security posture at the expense of ours. And fits this larger pattern of what the House Intelligence Committee was assessing is a growing problem from China, far from being a partner, let alone an ally in trying to contain North Korea. They're part of the problem.
Absolutely. And we have to really game plan this thing out carefully. I'm not sure we've done that up to this point, but I think with John Bolton as the national security advisor, who is a very clear thinker on the threat we face from North Korea and China, I believe we will be on the right path to a solution that will be in our cause and our allies' best interest.
We pray from your lips to God's ears, Admiral Ace Lyons. I share your strong enthusiasm for John Bolton and, for that matter, Mike Pompeo, two very capable men to have at the president's side during these challenging negotiations, and more to the point, in thinking through these very challenging times. We'll be talking more about them at some length with Bill Gertz, who's covered that hearing in the House Intelligence Committee. But we appreciate your taking the time, sir, to give us your assessment of the larger geostrategic picture we're facing in China and the Pacific region, your old area of operations and command. Thank you for your service to our country, sir, both in uniform and that which continues today, among other things, as the Military Committee of the Center for Security Policy's distinguished chairman. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Next up, Bill Gertz, inside the ring, inside the HPC hearing, right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit inside the ring. The man who takes us there each week is Bill Gertz, one of the country's foremost reporters on any topic, but most especially in terms of investigative reporting and analysis of national security policy. He writes as the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon. He is also the prize-winning columnist of the Inside the Ring column at the Washington Times. His seven best-selling books are required reading if you're interested in this part of the battle space. He is most especially to be complimented on his latest one, iWars, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill Gertz, it's good to have you back as always. Welcome.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Bill, we were talking with Admiral Lyons before we turned to this segment about a hearing that I think you covered for sure. Perhaps you were actually there in the House Intelligence Committee yesterday on the question of the rising military threat posed by communist China. Tell us what went down and the significance that you think we should assign to it.
Yeah, this was a very significant hearing by the House Intelligence Committee. It's the first of a series of hearings looking into the threat posed by China. I think this is a reflection of the president's new strategy, national security strategy, as well as the Pentagon's new national defense strategy, which looks at China and Russia as the top-tier threats facing the country. This is a major shift in policy, and I think it's being reflected now in some of the oversight committees. And the first hearing was to look at the worldwide expansion of the Chinese military. And it was also somewhat critical of U.S. intelligence for failing to understand this. In fact, Jim Fennell, retired Navy captain Jim Fennell, was the leadoff witness, and he was fairly critical. He said, look, our intelligence agencies had blinders on. They had groupthink. They told us 15 years ago that China was not a threat and we didn't have to worry about it, and they were wrong. And now we're trying to scramble to try and confront this emerging global hegemony. The China dream is global domination was the message that came through loud and clear from the testimony. Also included Rick Fisher and Dan Blumenthal and Patricia Kim from the Council on Foreign Relations.
You have been calling attention to the work of Captain Fennell for some time, and in fact some of his travails for making these kinds of warnings even when he was an intelligence officer out at Pacific Command, Bill Gertz. His testimony, I understand he's got some 64 pages of materials carefully documenting the threat and the misunderstanding of it and the failure to address it to date. It sounds as though it is a pretty powerful warning that if we don't take corrective action very quickly, we face the real prospect of perhaps decisive defeat at the hands of the Chinese communists. Is that right?
Yeah, Captain Fennell had a dire warning for America. He said there's a decade of concern that's going to begin in 2020 and stretch to 2030. And this is the period where he believes that China is going to strike Taiwan or perhaps take over the Senkaku, something that could trigger a major regional conflict. So he was definitely sounding the alarm on the China threat and on that score. And he made some recommendations for what the U.S. needs to do, mainly build up our Navy. It was a Navy-oriented threat briefing. And also to something I've advocated is increase our strategic messaging, basically wage information warfare and counter-information warfare against what the Chinese are doing.
Yeah. This is, of course, the subject of your new book, I War, Bill. And it does seem to me it's really a lost art now for a country that amazingly from, you know, Mad Men on has perfected and specialized in the practice of informing and influencing opinion. Why is it, as you see it, that this has become such a short suit for our country at this point? And at a moment when we're watching the FBI and others, including on Capitol Hill, increasingly seized with what China is doing, notably through its Confucius Institutes, but other outlets as well, the Xinhua News Agency, for example. Why is it we're so behind the power curve here, Bill?
It's really a failure of leadership. It's successive administrations have operated under the delusion that we don't face serious threats anymore. It was kind of the post-Cold War syndrome. In the case of China, clearly, our leadership is beginning to recognize that we have a serious problem in dealing with the threat from China. And again, the Chinese have figured out that it's not going to be military that's going to defeat the United States. They're going to do it with diplomatic intelligence, information, all types. It's a broad-based assault on the United States. And the reason that China is attacking the United States is because in order for China to achieve its dream of global hegemony or global domination, they've got to diminish U.S. power. And they're succeeding on doing that, in, again, on a number of fronts, most notably the economic front, which, again, is kind of the prime focus of the Trump administration at this point. It's hoped that they'll shift their focus to these other arenas as well, the intelligence threat, the diplomatic threat as well.
One of the people who I think it's fair to say has exemplified the misunderstanding or lowballing of the Chinese threat over the years is a former Obama administration State Department official by the name of Susan Thornton, who has inexplicably been nominated by the Trump administration to be the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs. You've reported, Bill, in your column this week that she may be in some trouble. Why so, and how certain is it that that will translate into her being replaced by somebody who actually gets the threat from China?
Yeah, Susan Thornton has been nominated to be the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs. It's the key policymaking role within the State Department for Asia and specifically China policy. Thornton has a known reputation for having conciliatory, appeasement-oriented policies towards China throughout the Obama administration, and yet she managed under Rex Tillerson to get nominated for the position. She's currently the acting Assistant Secretary for East Asia, so she's in one of those positions where, as an acting official, she's acting officially before she's been confirmed. Luckily, on Capitol Hill in the Senate, she has to go through a confirmation hearing, and she had her hearing in February, and her nomination has been stalled in the committee. It hasn't even gotten out of the committee, and thanks to the efforts of Senator Marco Rubio, who has basically said she has misled the Senate about her involvement in a incident in New York where she, as the Assistant Secretary of State, tried to block the FBI from arresting four Chinese security officials who had violated their visa in going to New York and trying to pressure a dissident Chinese billionaire named Guo Wangui. And she provided misleading and confusing answers about this. And I wrote about that in my column. And basically, she then supplied written answers, which kind of confirmed what she said in the hearing was different than what she said in her formal written answers to Senator Rubio.
Wow. Let me ask you finally, Bill, about a company that you've been raising an alarm about for some time. That would be ZTE. I can't for the life of me figure out why the President of the United States has decided that he wants to try to come to the rescue of this company, given its ties to the People's Liberation Army and the degree to which successive U.S. government officials have pointed to it as a real problem from an intelligence collection and penetration point of view. What's up with all of that, Bill?
Yeah, the ZTE matter has a lot of people in Washington, both in government and outside, scratching their heads. Basically, what happened was that ZTE violated U.S. sanctions by selling telecommunications equipment to Iran and North Korea in violation of U.S. export controls. They paid a fine of close to $1.5 billion, but they refused to take disciplinary action against the company officials involved, and that led to the Commerce Department saying no American companies can trade with ZTE for 7 years. This was hailed about a month ago as a great step forward in pressuring the Chinese into their illicit trade practices. Well, fast forward to the trade negotiations between China and the United States, and the president shocked everybody last Sunday by tweeting out that, hey, we've got to save jobs in China. We need to help this company. So he directed the Commerce Department to look into lifting these sanctions against ZTE. This, I'm certain, came from intense pressure from both the Chinese government and its running dogs in the Chinese pro-China sympathy community, and whether it's business or academia. I'm sure they put a lot of pressure on the White House to try and back down. They're in the middle of holding trade talks this week. It's not exactly clear what's actually going to come out. Alex Wong, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, testified this week that the president directed the Commerce Department to look at doing lifting these sanctions if it could be done within U.S. laws. And I'm not sure that it will be able to do that. I think that the law is pretty clear that if a company violates our export controls and laws, that these sanctions have to stay on.
This is a subject that we'll be turning to, I know, with you, Bill, in the future, as it bespeaks a larger problem within the U.S. government of turning a blind eye to an awful lot of behavior by the Chinese that's been deeply problematic. I think the Trump administration is trying to step up its game on this with respect to the theft of intellectual property, for example, and the acquisition of cutting-edge American companies that are likely to wind up being exploited by the Chinese to our detriment, perhaps even our national security detriment. But this is a time for a very close rethink about what we've been doing with respect to China. And we appreciate the contributions you make to that each week in your superb writing at the Washington Free Beacon. Next up, we'll speak with Nick Kausar about Iran and what we best be doing to try to help the rebellion there right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I am very pleased to say we are joined for, I believe, the first time by Nikahang Kausar. He is an Iranian-Canadian cartoonist who is now residing in and working as a geologist in Washington, D.C. He became quite famous within his own country and actually was imprisoned over one of his cartoons, which portrayed what he calls a Professor Crocodile, shedding crocodile tears as it garroted a reporter, a very pointed critique of the repressive regime of the mullahs in Tehran. He is joining us, having written a very interesting piece, drawing parallels between the Star Wars saga and what is happening inside Iran at the moment, and the role that the United States might play as well. It appeared at Medium on the internet. Let me just say, Nick Kausar, thank you so much for joining us and for your willingness to share some insights about what's happening in your native country and what we might most usefully do to have it come out right. Welcome. Good to have you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So tease out for us a little bit some of the parallels that you drew between the Star Wars story and what's happening in Iran at the moment.
When I was watching the latest episode, if you will, of Star Wars, I was just thinking that there is something between what's happening in Iran and what we have seen in Star Wars. You see a group of rebels who are fighting against the Empire, the evil Empire, and the evil Empire actually looks like Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's system. The stormtroopers look like the Basijis, members of Revolutionary Guards, and they don't think about what they're doing, what's their cause. They just want to oppress the rebellion, but don't think about it. But there are some members that are actually thinking twice. That's why they leave the stormtroopers. Like in the latest parts of Star Wars, we have Finn, who actually quits being a part of the Empire. But the whole thing is that this main struggle between the rebellion and the Emperor's army is something that we are seeing very clearly in Iran. And the regime has turned the country into a dry, arid land. Of course, I should say Iran has never been a very, let's say, prosperous and green country. But it wasn't like this when the revolution happened.
Yeah. And I want to tease that out in a moment with you, because I gather that it is a contributing factor, the dearth of water, to the rebellion and what is driving it at the moment. But could you just characterize, as you understand it, Nick Kausar, how widespread the rebellion is in Iran at the moment?
Let's say about 9 years ago, when we had the Green Movement, the so-called Green Movement, we had it in major, bigger cities and partially a number of smaller cities. But it wasn't a widespread movement at that time. And the regime understood it and was able to control the whole thing. But what happened in January of this year was a widespread unrest all around the country, where people who mostly had nothing to lose actually joined the movement. And one important factor is, in a country where people, farmers especially, lose their lands, their livelihoods, many are under a situation that have to leave their own homes and live in ghettos because there's no water, there's no food, and there are no jobs. And we have seen this in other places. There have been parallels like this. We have seen it in Syria. We have seen it in Yemen. We have seen it in Northern Africa because of bad water management, because of bad food production policies that led to exploitation, over-exploitation of aquifers, and the groundwater was...
And pollution, I understand, is another contributing factor, right?
Yes, but the pollution that we have is in major, bigger cities, not in smaller cities. What we saw was an unrest majorly in all around the country, especially in smaller cities that had been hit by the water crisis. I essentially want to use water crisis, not drought, because whenever we talk about drought, we think of climate change, global warming. But no, my emphasis is on bad water policies.
And again, you've spent time inside Evin Prison, the dreaded incarceration center in Tehran. You know what this regime is capable of, and presumably everybody who's in the streets at the moment does as well, and yet they're out there. Is this motivated in a way that is likely actually to threaten this regime in Iran, Nick Kausar? And if so, it would seem to me that it's very much in our interest that it succeed. Are there things that the United States could be doing to help those in the rebellion as they battle the Death Star?
Yes, that's my short answer. And the longer answer is, when you look at what happened in the late 1980s and early 1990s that brought down the apartheid regime in South Africa, was when there were targeted sanctions that people understood why the world was putting pressure on the South African regime at that time. One thing that's happening right now is that because of this recent move by President Trump to move out of the nuclear deal, many Iranian leaders are a little bit frightened because of the impact of these targeted sanctions. And they are mostly relying on the help or support of the European Union, China, and Russia. But let's say European corporations and East Asian companies understand that there is a price to pay if they deal with the Iranian regime. What happened to Total France? That they said, oh, we will not wait for, let's say, decisions made by Europe, and we will pull out of Iran.
This is the effect of the secondary sanctions that would say basically to them, you can do business with Iran if you choose, but you can't do business with the United States. And they've made the calculation that they'd rather do business with us. So this seems to be beginning to catch fire in Europe. And I gather you're saying that this would intensify the pressure on the regime and be of help to the people of Iran. I think all of us understand, Nick, that this business of sanctions is a bit of a blunt instrument, and it will have some negative impact on the people there as well as the government. But it's a necessary step, I gather you're saying, to undercut what control the regime continues to be able to exercise repressively over its own people. Is that right?
Yes. Unfortunately, it will have some effect on the public. Let's say the currency exchange rate actually changed dramatically even before President Trump made his decision. A few months ago, you could purchase $1 for something under 40,000 riyals. Now it's above 70,000 riyals. It has its impact on many things in the country, even on taxi fares, although you don't need to import taxis to get a ride, but it has its own effect on everything in the country. Or the upper middle class that want to travel abroad have problems getting currency, and it's going to be a hard situation for many people. I understand it totally, but let's not think that it's going to have a major effect on everything, because pharmaceuticals are still going through, and people may have some problems with, let's say, buying their drugs, but it's because of bad regime policies, not sanctions.
Nick Kalsar, thank you very much for sharing your insights and for the work that you're doing at the moment to try to address the catastrophe now afflicting Iran in terms of its man-induced drought, its regime-induced drought, to be more precise. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. And I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.